So we've been doing this this series since Christmas, really, called Searchlight, and it's all about big questions about life and faith and Jesus. And today we're going to look at the question of why would God be interested in me? But here's a picture from my wedding day. I did extremely well, didn't I? Strangely well. And I've been married for more than 10 years to my wonderful wife, Naomi, and I want to tell you how we got together. So cast your minds back in the distant mists of time to 2005. Picture the north in the city of Newcastle. It's darker and colder and everyone talks funny. Why? And I'd graduated and Naomi was a third year medical student. We're part of the same church. We'd known each other vaguely for a couple of years. I thought she was very easy on the eye. But beyond that, we didn't know each other very well at all. And I'd been in third year when she was in first year, which meant that she thought I was really grown up and mature, which I wasn't. But that's what naive first years always think about third years at university. Anyway, I was working for a Christian charity where part of my job was to talk to people about big questions around God. And that summer, 2005, I was going on a short trip to the Middle East to do exactly that with some students. And a few weeks before I went, I happened to speak to Naomi after church while we were having coffee. And I said, would you be up for praying for me while I go on this mission trip to this other country and talk about God? Which is the worst Christian chat-up line of all time. But she said yes. So I went on this trip. And every few days, I emailed people back home about everything that was going on. And some people replied with a line or two. But Naomi replied to every email within a few hours with a huge essay about what was going on in her own life. And after this happened about four times, I thought to myself, maybe the very easy on the eye girl at church is interested in me. Wow. Anyway, after the trip, I got home. Unfortunately, there was no reason to email each other anymore because we lived in the same town. But I thought, I want to continue this. I like talking to her. So I came up with the second worst chat-up line in the history of Christianity. I said to her, I didn't say this to anybody else, I only said this to her, would you like to see the photos from the trip where I was talking to people about God? And again, she said yes. So I got my laptop and I went round to her house. And there was nobody else in, which was a good sign. She obviously thought I wasn't a threat. And I sat on the sofa and I opened up the laptop and started getting the pictures. And then I really took the hint because she came and sat next to me. And when I say she sat next to me, she was virtually sat on me. There was no remaining surface area on the left of my body. And at that moment, I thought, yes, Matt, you are in here. Well played. And it turned out, actually, that she'd liked me for ages and she'd been waiting for an opportunity to spend time together for about a year. Although literally nobody who knows us both believes me when I say this. Everybody presumes I wore down her resilience over a long time and eventually she caved. But it's not true. But one of the things I appreciated about Naomi right from the start and still do is she was always interested in me. She'd ask questions and find out what I was doing or what I thought about something. Or she'd find out what I was interested in and buy me a present that was related to it. And she still does, actually. And it's just lovely when that happens, isn't it? It's great. There is something significant, something special when somebody pursues you in some way. Not just romantically. But when somebody pursues you, they're not just around you. They actually pursue you. They come after you. And in Luke's Gospel, one of the accounts of Jesus' life, chapter 15, it's mostly talking about God's pursuit of us. It's all about God's relentless interest in us. And here is the backdrop. Tax collectors and other notorious sinners often came to listen to Jesus teach. This made the Pharisees and teachers of religious law complain that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them. So it all begins, this story, when some of the religious leaders of Jesus' day notice he seems to attract and even befriend tax collectors and sinners. Now, sinners meant the sort of general moral outcasts of the society, people everybody thought was bad. But tax collectors, well, they were notorious for being mercenaries who overcharged. Everybody hated them. Nobody socialized with them, but they were rich. That was the trade-off. And the religious leaders are confused because Jesus is this exciting, popular teacher. Why on earth is he spending time with these people out of anybody? He has a choice. He doesn't have to spend time with them. He chooses to. And they're probably also thinking that Jesus is a bit soft. In their minds, what these people need to hear is hard words. They need to be given it straight. They're living the wrong way and God's angry with them and they need to buck their ideas up fast. Jesus should be giving, from their point of view, Jesus should be giving good, strong, old-fashioned moral advice and encouraging change. That's not how he sees it. Jesus responds by telling them some stories that are very simple in one way, but actually challenge how everybody sees God and how to respond to him. And this is just one of those stories we're going to look at today. So Jesus told them this story. If a man has 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what will he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness and go to search for the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. When he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, because I found my lost sheep." In the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. Very, very simple story on the face of it. But what this says about God, it's amazing. It could change your life. So let's break it down. And it starts with a question. If a man has 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what will he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness and go and search for the one that is lost until he finds it? Now, if I'd been there listening to Jesus, I'd have been nodding and going, "Yes, Jesus, that's right. I'd go after the one sheep, just like you say." But what I would actually be thinking is, what? Leave 99 sheep to find the other one? I can't be bothered with that. Traipsing around the wilderness looking for one sheep? No thanks. I've still got 99 sheep. How many sheep does a man need? 99 is perfectly satisfactory. Now, the parable never mentions that it's a shepherd who's in charge here, which implies that this could be the owner of the flock. One of his sheep has gone away, it's escaped. He's more invested in the fate of the sheep than his employees would be if he's the owner. So they're left with 99 of them being looked after while he goes off looking for this one. But how did this happen? How does a sheep get lost in the first place? It's probably helpful to step back for a second and think about what Jesus means when he talks about being lost. This story is one of three that Jesus strings together, and they're all about something being lost. And when Jesus talks about lostness, what he actually means is separation from God. That's the spiritual side of it. Separation from God, being distant from God. And he uses these three stories to tell us the different ways that a person can be lost. The first one, and this is one of the other stories he tells, is there's a lost coin. A coin gets lost. Now, of course, a coin is an inanimate object. It is the victim of circumstances. And one way we can become distant from God is just that. This idea is actually quite popular in our society right now. You are the victim. You experience bad being done to you, and it forms you. The system society has in place have done you over. Maybe your family treated you badly, or your community, or perhaps even you had a bad church experience. And there is definitely truth in this, but it's only one dimension of lostness. And on its own, it can easily become an excuse, can't it? I do bad because other people did bad to me. They formed me. It's not my responsibility. That's one form of lostness. Another is like a wayward son. We looked at this story in detail about a month ago. This is when a person becomes lost because they make deliberate bad choices. The son in the story takes his dad's inheritance and runs off and wastes it. It's his choice. And we all know someone who has done this in some way in their own life. And quite often, our society has less sympathy for this person. Well, it's their own fault. They chose to do that and that. Well, it's on them. And the danger of this in isolation is that we presume that we know the motives and the backstory, and we tend to sit in judgment presuming that a person is lost because they made deliberate bad choices alone. When part of what Jesus is saying here is that that minimizes what it is for a person to be lost. There's always more to it. And then thirdly, today's story is a lost sheep. A third type of lostness. Ignorance. You see, the thing is with sheep is that they're basically stupid. I don't mean to be offensive to sheep. If anyone here identifies as a sheep or you've got a close friend that's a sheep, I'm really sorry. They are basically stupid. Wool is very useful and lamb is delicious, but sheep are stupid. They don't get lost because they've got some big evil plan. And they don't get lost because of somebody else's bad choices. They get lost because they don't know any better. They don't know. They just don't know. And so Jesus is showing us that to be lost from God is generally more complicated than we think of it. Let's work through an example. Let's say that Bob is always late for things. Not a big deal in the grand scheme of things, but he's always late for stuff. Why is he always late? One perspective is that Bob's parents were always late for things. It's what he saw growing up. It's what was modeled to him. He was directed by circumstances. So he's like the coin, so to speak. It's not him. It's happened to him and it affects him. Another is that Bob can't be bothered to wait for people. So he's always the last to arrive, so he doesn't have to wait around. They can wait for him. So basically, he's selfish. He's like the sun. It's deliberate bad behavior, bad choices. Another perspective is that Bob doesn't realize how annoying it is when he's late. He doesn't get how it affects other people. He doesn't have a clue. He's like the sheep. He's just ignorant. He doesn't know. Now, that's a very sedate example, a very relaxed example. Let's imagine a more serious one. Imagine that Dave is a habitual liar. Not you, Dave Lawson. Hypothetical Dave. He's a habitual liar. He just lies constantly. He lies to his family. He lies at work. He lies to his friends. Most of the time, they're not big lies. They're just little white lies to make him look good or get him out of taking the blame for something that was his fault. And of course, there are consequences. People intuitively don't trust him. The real Dave isn't really known to people. It messes up his relationships. Why is Dave like this? Is it because Dave's friends always lied to him growing up? And that's all he's ever known. It's the pattern he saw. He inherited it. It's bad circumstances. Is it because Dave is just more naturally prone to lying? It's just a bad character trait that he has. He knows he's doing it, but he can play little games in his head to justify it. It's his choices. It's his responsibility. Or is it because, on some level, Dave doesn't have a clue? He doesn't realize he's telling lies even. It's become so habitual. It doesn't occur to him. His instinct is just to say what gets him out of a difficult situation because he's afraid of the consequences. On some level, he's ignorant like the sheep. He just doesn't realize. All of these perspectives have elements of truth to them, but none of them's the whole picture. Our big problem is this deeply unfashionable word, sin. Very Christian word, sin. And people understand this in different ways. The religious people that Jesus would have spoken to would have thought that they understood it. They thought it's good behavior or bad behavior. You get on with the good behavior, everything's great. Bad behavior, not so great. Simple. But the way that Jesus captures the essence of lostness, the essence of the human problem, is more comprehensive and more multidimensional than many people who've tried to diagnose it since. And the thing is, if you only understand one or two of the dimensions, you end up with incomplete solutions. If you think it's all about circumstances, the bad in your life is all about circumstances, being on the receiving end of bad things, the emphasis will always be to look for counseling and therapy. If you think it's all about bad choices, the emphasis will be on control and restriction and criticism or even punishment. If you think it's all about ignorance, the emphasis is on education. If people knew enough, they wouldn't do bad things, surely. Again, all have elements of truth to them. And all these solutions have an important place. But Jesus is showing us the problem is deeper and wider than we would like to admit. Our spiritual lostness is great. And spiritually, we mirror these stories because we're like the coin. In some ways, we're victims of what happens. But sometimes we're like the wayward son. We're rebellious and we're selfish and we just want our own thing. And here, like the sheep, sometimes we're just naive. We just don't know. We just don't realize. The Christian understanding of lostness isn't just some bad behavior or a few things that you like doing that God randomly frowns on for some reason. It's really complicated. It's innate within us. It's magnified when we're treated badly. It's deepened by our choices. And each of us is naive to how far-reaching it goes. But back to the sheep. Let's expand on that facet of lostness. As we said, it's not necessarily that you've done something very deliberately. It's not something that's been done to you and it's shaped you. This is when you just don't know any better. You don't have the resources, the wisdom to know any better. This is you sort of drift into a mess or something bad naively, and you didn't realize. And by definition, this is really hard to spot in your own life at any time. How would you know that this was happening? How would you know that you were naive about something? But one way to think about it is to think back on your own life and think about how at different points you can look back and think, wow, I had no idea when I was that age. Surely it's not just me that does that. I cannot be the only person in this room who looks back at myself 10 years ago, 20 years ago and thinks, oh my goodness, I can't believe I did that. I think about when I was a teenager and how I trampled on other people because I was trying to look cool. And I wasn't even aware of it at the time, but I am now. And I go, oh my goodness. I think about when I was in my early 20s and I was argumentative and I was very black and white about issues that should really be more nuanced. And I was so convinced I was right about a whole number of things. I dishonored other people and didn't listen to them. Wasn't even aware at the time. Whereas now it's complete facepalm territory. I mean, it took me a year to realize that my wife was interested in me. I am a first order idiot. Surely, please tell me, it is not just me that looks back and thinks, I was so stupid. I can't believe I thought that. I can't believe I did that. I have just had no clue. It's not just me, is it? Thank you. The scary thing is, if you can look back at 10 years ago and cringe at your own foolishness, is it not very possible that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you look back at right now and think, oh man, what an idiot. Is that possible? That should make all of us pause. Jesus is saying in this story, this is the human condition. Yeah, you'll learn stuff, you'll improve hopefully in some ways, but you'll also look back and cringe. And in doing so, you get a small glimpse of how lost you are when left to your own devices. Right now, all of us, every one of us, is lost in ways that we are blind to, that we don't know. And here and there, we might get some criticism or some feedback or something goes wrong, and that gives us a glimpse too, and it's very uncomfortable when that happens to you. But usually we're blind to the extent of our own lostness. And just like the sheep, we think and do things that leave us spiritually alone in the wilderness with no way home, nobody who has any insight to fix it, and no clue what to do. Anybody depressed yet? Doesn't sound great, does it? Well, fortunately, we're not at the end of the story. In the story, the good news is the owner comes to get the sheep. Sure, he's got 99 other sheep, but he's still interested to pursue the one, to come and get the one. And just to be clear, this is not the owner saying to the sheep, hey, sheep, you're not stupid, really. You're really clever. You know what you're doing. I'm just available. No, no, no. That's not what's happening. The owner is well aware of the truth. He knows the sheep is a sheep. It's stupid. And he comes anyway. That has to be of great reassurance to your average foolish sheep. What does the owner do? And when he's found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. The sheep isn't in trouble. The owner isn't waiting to have a go at him and lecture him on the stupidity of wandering off. It's a sheep. He just puts the sheep on his shoulders and walks home with a smile on his face. He's just pleased to have the sheep back. Simple as that. And then it all gets a little bit excessive. When he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbours saying, rejoice with me because I found my lost sheep. I don't know about you. I've never been to a recently found sheep party. I don't think that they exist. In fact, I don't think even in first century Israel that people would have a recently found sheep party. I think when the owner invited all his friends to a social gathering based around newly recovered livestock, they would have thought he was weird. It's only one sheep, mate. You've got another 99 of them. Why are we doing this? The whole point is, this would have seemed over the top to everybody else. The joy and the celebration this owner has in finding the sheep is disproportionate to the value of the sheep. It makes no sense to anybody else. Do you see that the sheep is not supposed to be this valuable? It's not supposed to make the owner so happy. Look at what the sheep contributes to society. Jumpers and kebabs. Now, kebabs are lovely, admittedly. It's not enough to get this excited about. And it's not like it's his only sheep either. He's got loads of them. But for some reason, the owner loves his sheep. And the sheep has value, not because it's special in itself, but because, and only because, the owner has decided to invest it with significance and value and even love. It's a stupid sheep, but it's his stupid sheep. That's the story. But of course, it's meant to make a spiritual point. In the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. This is how God feels about every single one of us. And it's not meant to say, okay, there's 99 who don't need anything and there's the occasional one who's a problem. All the other 99 sheep are lost in their own ways too at different points. Now, you might look around this room and think, wow, look at all these people who don't have any issues. They're fine, but it's just me. I can't fit in because I'm that one out of the 100 in some way. But I guarantee you, I know enough about enough people in this room personally to tell you everybody has issues. Everybody has weaknesses. Everybody is the one out of 100 in their own way. There really is no such thing as people who are righteous who haven't strayed away. This is Jesus addressing his audience of very religious people and incorporating their own view of themselves into the conversation. He's saying, you think you're righteous. You think you have it together. You think you understand what it is to be lost. But the joy of God, the delight of God, is with those who realize what they are and come home. He will come after every single sheep. He feels the same way about everyone. But where it's different for us from the sheep in the story is that we don't have to come home. Jesus uses the word repent, another unfashionable one. But literally, it means to turn around, to realize and recognize your own sheep-likeness, your own naivety when left to your own devices, and come back to God. He loves us enough to even afford us the dignity of choice when it comes to him. So this story, although it tells us some uncomfortable things about ourselves, it also tells us something wonderful about God and how he pursues us. When you look at all the big worldviews, all the well-known religions of the world, and while there's differences, they all sort of seem to agree in some ways that if we sincerely search for God or whatever God is, according to what they believe, we'll find him. Millions of people in the world believe that. Well, if we do things the right way, then we'll find God. You've just got to work hard and seek and read and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, that view sets it up as though God is the sheep and we are the owner, diligently out looking because he's hard to find. That view makes us sound good. But the Bible in general, and Jesus here in particular, turns that idea on its head. God is the owner of the sheep who goes out to seek and save that which is lost. And he does so with joy. He chooses to with joy. So don't miss the fact, this is completely different. Religion says we can search for and find God if we try hard enough, if we do the right things, if we look in the right places, put the work in. But this is radical because it says, no. God has come to seek and save us. The answer is in what he does, not we do, what we do. He is the hero of the story, and it is so much better that way. The strong temptation for religious people is not to see themselves as lost, to think, well, we're okay. We're in church. We do this sort of bit of serving here and there. We've done the work. Those guys, oh, I can see why they're lost, but we're not. But God looks at it very differently. He just delights in pursuing people who are lost and bringing them back home. He delights in it. And you might wonder, the obvious question of all this, how does God come to get us? And how is Jesus involved in this? He tells a great story, sure, but how does he know? What's his insight here? The night before Jesus was nailed to a cross, he celebrated the Jewish Passover festival with his disciples. And the Passover meal is an annual celebration. And when it's done properly, according to all the traditions, it includes bread and wine, and the best quality lamb that you can get your hands on. And when Jesus celebrates it the night before his death, there is bread and wine on the table, and he uses them. And Jesus, he makes a point about himself with that bread and wine. But it doesn't recall that there's any lamb at the meal. Why is there no lamb? Did Jesus forget? Seems unlikely. The idea is that Jesus himself is that lamb. Which may sound very strange, but the idea is that in his death, Jesus, in a sense, becomes a helpless, stupid sheep, just like us, on our behalf, taking on our lostness, including all the bad things that have shaped us, all our bad choices, and of course, our own very much sheep-likeness, where we just had no clue. So the answer to that big question, is God really interested in me, is yes, absolutely, absolutely. He knows what you're like. He knows that you're worse than you think you are. Jesus doesn't minimize those things. He doesn't say they're not true. But if he knows those things and he still pursues you with joy, what do you have to worry about with God? Why wouldn't you turn toward him and come home, whether that's for the first time or for the 1,000th time? It's all he's after. Richard, can we put that alpha slide on the screen? So this is the end of this Searchlight series that we've been doing these recent few weeks, asking these big questions. And it might be that you've been relatively new to this church in that time. You're exploring things. We run this thing called Alpha. The next one starts on the 25th of February, a Tuesday, at our church building, 77 The Strand. You can sign up online, or you can have a chat with me, or we'd love to have you there. Please do sign up. You're welcome to attend, even if you haven't signed up. It just helps to know for numbers. But the whole point of Alpha is to discuss all of this stuff, to discuss God, to discuss what he's like, to discuss how he comes and gets us, to discuss who Jesus is. It's all the stuff we've talked about in the last few weeks, but with a bit more time, a bit more discussion, and a free meal every week. What's not to like? So please do sign up for Alpha if this is something you want to explore. But also, you might be like, yeah, I agree with all this Searchlight stuff, all the stuff we talked about today. I agree with it. I'm already a Christian. I'm there. Isn't it brilliant being a Christian? Isn't it brilliant knowing the love of God for you? Yes, all five of you. Isn't it brilliant? People need to know about this. It is life transforming and changing. Please do invite people to Alpha. Do you know what is the absolute worst thing that will happen if you invite someone to Alpha? They'll say no. That's probably about as bad as it's going to be. But as good as it could be is they come along and they get to meet Jesus for themselves. And isn't that wonderful? So why not invite people? Neighbours, people at the shop, people in the school playground, whoever it is, why not invite anyone to Alpha? Let me pray, and then we're going to worship some more. Father, thank you that you do come after us, that you love us despite what we're like. And while on some level that's unsettling, also it's the most reassuring thing in the world, that it's not about what we do. It's not about us earning our way to you, reading the right religious texts, etc., etc., etc. It's just that you come after us. Nothing could be better. Thank you that even though we're in our own different ways, we're naive and we're foolish like sheep, you still come after us and you carry us home joyfully. Thank you, Lord. Amen.